So we've got a great panel, a big panel of people here. So we're going to have a long conversation. We've just had a very interesting conversation in the break. So if I can recreate what we've just been talking about in the break, it'll be a good panel session. So I'm going to start it off with Johnny. What is a fan, Johnny? Talk us through what sports federations, brands are looking for. How are they defining fans? How do we segment them? What's the demographic? Can you talk us through that?
Okay, well, a fan by definition has an interest or a passion for something. That something could be a sport, it could be a team, it could be a club, or it could be an athlete. But there's a lot of variance within that, so we need to sort of frame that, put it into a framework and a simple audience segmentation model to think about to help this is think about it in the context of a pyramid. And at the top of the pyramids, we have our avid core sports fans, which are the most loyal, the most long-serving, the most really invested in our sport, in an athlete, in a competition or an event. Beneath that, we might have a casual fan, which is somebody who connects with a sport or a team, but just on a less frequent basis. Beneath that, we may have a social fan who connects with a sport or a team through their social peers. For me, that would be I'm a fan of Portsmouth Football Club, but only when I meet up with my family when I travel to Portsmouth. And then at the bottom of the pyramid, we may have general sports fans, which really don't have a connection to any particular sport, but just love sport in general. The key thing to understand is the difference between fans at each of these segments. And there's three variables that are sort of things to explore. One is time. We're in a world where we're competing for people's leisure time. How much time are people prepared to invest in something? The second one is financial investment. How much are you prepared to actually spend to follow your sport, a team? And the third one, which from our point of view is often the most important, is the amount of emotional investment you're prepared to make into a sport or a team. And these are the things that we need to explore and see how we can exploit them. And rights holders and agencies like us, our role is one, to understand fans within each of these segments in order to talk to them, in order to engage them in a relevant way in the context of their lives, wherever they are around the world, with very different financial pressures in different parts of the world, for example. And then also what we want to try and do is we want to try and move fans from one audience segment into another audience segment, which is usually upwards in the pyramid. And then finally, we can look at what at Red Torch we talk about exploring fans from the point of view of consuming sports in the media, a lot of which has been talked about, and then also participating in sports. And there's very different behaviours and motivations as to why people consume sports in the media versus why people participate in sports. So we need to understand this environment. We need to understand fans in order to be able to engage with them and then influence their behaviour.
That's great. So Alice, you're recently with Deloitte. You've only been there a very short time, but I gather there's been a very interesting report that Deloitte's have produced around the Leader Week. So could you talk us a little bit through the report and why? What was driving Deloitte's to do that?
Yeah, sure. So afternoon, everyone. So at Deloitte, we collaborate with the leaders network, the 40 under 40, so the sort of the brightest sparks in the sports industry that are really shaping the future of the industry, and that's a global network of leaders. We collaborate with them around a range of thought leadership topics, and convene sort of networking opportunities where we discuss what really are the key trends that are shaping the future of sport. That network voted that the future fan was probably one of the key trends that was going to be shaping where the industry went over the coming years. So kind of a really important topic for them, theme, and something that fed into this report that we released with them. So just to pick out on some of the key messages, I think the first one was really around traditional sports not connecting in the same way, failing to connect in the same way with that younger generation of fans, so Gen Z fans. There was a piece of research that we looked at as part of that report, which showed that only 23% of Gen Z describe themselves as passionate sports fans, and that's compared to 42% of millennials. And we're seeing that decline kind of looking to increase over the coming years. So really, what it's driving is the need for traditional sports to think about different ways of connecting with the younger fans. Yeah.
And I can imagine, you know, that's an increasing trend, isn't it, in terms of sport having to kind of rethink its offering. Maybe I could just switch in here to Jonathan at that point, just to say, you had quite an interesting weekend, Jonathan, the whole modern pentathlon movement has changed one of its core sports. Yes. So is what Alice is talking about, is that really driving that process? Is that one of the reasons why this has happened?
Exactly, yes. The weekend, the Modern Pentathlon Congress voted to replace riding with obstacle discipline as one of the five disciplines. And just for context, in case anyone doesn't know a lot about modern pentathlon, it has been continuously in the Olympic Games since 1912. It was very much the brainchild of Coubertin himself. But the sport has survived in the Olympic Games all these years without, I would argue, attracting a fan base. I think there's a community around the sport which has already always been loyal. But that's very much a friends and family network. It's people with vested interests. And then obviously the Olympics come along and you watch the athlete from your country and you hope that they succeed. But for the other 4 years, we don't have fans in the sport. And a huge driver of the change is to create a new fan base and a new era for the sport. And that's why obstacle discipline has become such an attractive option and very much a no-brainer, if you ask me, because obstacle discipline incorporates all the things that you may have heard of, such as the participation endurance elements, such as Tough Mudder, Spartan. We estimate there are 20 million participants worldwide. So that is not only a huge participation base, but all of those athletes are potentially fans, depending on your definition and where they sit in that pyramid. And then separately, there's a television audience, and primarily led by Ninja Warrior, which many of you may have seen. We're looking at potentially around 1 billion people watching some form of obstacle sport on TV. So you can understand how the marriage really made sense.
And was obstacle the only choice, or did you kind of have a favourite group of other sports? Were there other things?
I'm conscious that the competition for Olympic places is sitting right next to me in tech ball. There was huge, a consultation with over 61 proposals considered. I have to say, obstacle just shone through, and it scored very highly in every round of that process. But what appeals to me from a communications side of things is that we've never really had what you might refer to as a play in modern pentathlon. There is no snippet. There's no 30-second clip that you can really share on social media. And I shared a clip from Tech Ball maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago with my friends. It was an incredible 30 seconds of action. We've never had that in obstacle discipline, potentially with a head-to-head race lasting maybe 30 seconds. It potentially gives us that content and that really shareable asset.
Seems a good point to bring in Tech Ball. Sorry, Brendan, I'll come to you in a second, but I'm just running down the panel here. So, talk us through Tech Ball. You talked about 8 million followers. Are they fans? Are they people that are really engaged with the sport? Or are they people that just love watching YouTube clips or TikTok clips?
Yeah, first of all, thanks for sharing. This is a good question. Are they fans or are they just followers? Of course, some of them are just followers because they like watching it, but maybe they don't like playing it or they just can't play tag ball. We have 8 million followers on TikTok, Facebook, and Instagram. And we're lucky because they are very active. They comment, they like our posts, they share our posts. So they make a big buzz around the sport. Maybe it's a good rally, or just a big smash, or a very, very nice save or something. But what we can see is that now people are coming to our competitions. It happened in Krakow. We had a big World Series event there with almost 200 players from all over the world. And we had five finals during on Sunday. And the men and women singles, men and women doubles, and mixed doubles. And we build up in the main square of Krakow, a small stadium for 500 people. And after, for the first match, it was full. After the first match, half of the audience left, and it filled again. This happened all the time for all the five finals, and we're very happy about that because we can see that thousands of people were interested in watching the final on site. And after that, we could watch the Eurosport data that 3.2 million people watched on Eurosport. So we can say that, yes, they are fans as well. They follow us, but they are fans as well.
Brendan, what's it looking like in the Caribbean? What's the sort of fan base of sport out there? Is it young? Is it old? Is it changing? What's the feeling?
Well, in the Caribbean, we have a mixed fan base where you have all persons, all types of persons from different sectors who embrace sport, and let alone different types of sport. I mean, in the Caribbean, we are known for cricket, but we have persons who are followers of soccer or football. So our fan base is mixed. For example, for me, while I was competing as an athlete, she could see on my face I'm relatively young, I was able to attract a diverse group of fans from all sectors of society. But it's not only because of my sporting achievements, but also due to my involvement in socioeconomic development initiatives within my country and a cross-section of the Caribbean. And moreover, I was able to amass the following due to the stories I was able to create within the community, where the focus was not placed only on sports, but as Chris placed on creating an impact for the less fortunate, single mothers, and vulnerable. This is done by creating linkages with the donor groups who are able to aid in a time of need. So being an athlete and also having that social cause, we're able to bridge the gap. So that what you would find is that persons would be able to follow the sport. Additionally, with youth on my side, I was able to bridge that gap with young, who see me as a role model, and the middle-aged who I work with on a professional level and who I lean to advise. Therefore, they followed my journey, encouraging me to be a true representative of my community, country, and region. Also offering their input and assistance to invoke change within a community, thus strengthening my personal brand and those with whom I was involved with or affiliated with. So it's basically not only being an athlete, but also having an inspiring story, created a fandom within my community and country. So that's what the Caribbean likes, a story. Someone who came from basically nothing to something and they could actually relate to.
Do you think athletes are doing enough to kind of bring fans into the sport? Is that a thing that more people are doing, more athletes are doing?
Yes. If I go on to the recently concluded Commonwealth Games, a lot of athletes, they had a story. They had that social cause which they were advocating for. We have now the LGBTQ. We have now who are for climate resiliency and other social causes like Black Lives Matter. So with their stories, their social media, they become influencers, not only for the sport, but for their personal brand, and they attract fans into the sport so that they can relate to what's going on.
Yeah, and coming back to you, Johnny, data's really important here, presumably, and certainly Alice, the same for Deloitte's. How are sport using data well enough? Are we able to sort of capture what's going on? From your report, Alice, maybe Johnny, you take it, and perhaps Alice, you could follow.
Yes, it's hugely important. I mean, there's a lot of different types of data out there, which is good for in different ways for different reasons. Simple, you know, data sets you can gather from qualitative surveys can be used to actually inform, you know, product development. We talk about, you know, new products like the 100 or other short form formats that enable a more simple entry point into a sport. Then there's other data sets which are more probably, you know, when you know you hear a lot of chat in the industry about first-party data, which the important data in there is actually behavioural data. Is being able to track who is interested in what, how often are they participating in something, and then being able to identify those trends and then leverage those trends in order to influence that behaviour. And then the data that's super important for us, from a creative point of view, is understanding people's motivations to participate in something, which is a key data point, because once you understand why someone participates in something, then you can develop a creative means to influence them on an emotional level in order to change their behaviour. And often driving behavioural change is very, very difficult, and you need something strong and powerful like emotion to do that, which sometimes the sport itself can create. We saw a great example, if anyone watched the All Blacks against England in the Women's Rugby World Cup. Amazing game, huge emotion at the end of it. But to be influenced by that emotion, you will have already had to have been a fan engaged with that sport. So the challenge then is, how do you connect with somebody who's not engaged with a sport and bring them into a sport? And again, emotion is super important there. But it's important to understand the data to understand the entry points that you need to create for people to enter that sport. Classic example that's, again, talked a lot about in the sports industry is the F1 Drive to Survive. The entry point was the point of entertainment, okay, on a channel that millions of people around the world are using. But the entry point for other people might be health and well-being. It could be sustainability. It could be social. You know, there's lots of other things that we need to understand, and that's why the data is important. The data is important to ensure that the product, the way that we communicate, is all culturally relevant here today to have impact.
Alice.
Yeah, and we're seeing a really interesting example of that in our partnership with the LTA. So we've been working on a two-year partnership with them, and one of the big drivers around that was opening up the game of tennis, opening up to new communities, perhaps communities where they haven't traditionally played tennis in the past. There have been barriers to participation, whether sort of real or imagined. And one of the key drivers around that was, how do we get data in potential participants' hands? So how do we build the bottom of the pyramid, if you like, in terms of building a fan base for the sport by getting people to play some tennis in their local parks? And one of the sort of the drivers was to make it as easy to find and book a tennis court as it is to order a takeaway. So one of the pieces of research that came out was that people want to get active, want to participate in tennis in this example, but they don't know how and where. And so the opening up tennis is all about making it as easy as possible for people to find out where they can pick up a racket and play the sport. So useful in terms of data from a participant or a potential participant, a future fan perspective. Also really useful from the LTA's perspective. So actually, where are people playing tennis? Which communities are we still sort of not reaching? And what can we do to better engage with those communities through the sport? So really sort of a golden thread that runs throughout that partnership.
And of course, you know, in tennis now, you've got this new sport, paddle, which is, you know, increasingly becoming hugely popular around the world. And, you know, certainly in the London community, I'm meeting more and more people who are playing paddle tennis more than tennis. So it's interesting to see that there's a new dimension as we're talking about changing, refreshing new sports. You're looking at that, Jonathan, really, really clearly. Does obstacle then bring in the opportunity to get that engagement you've never had before in that respect?
It really does, and change is the key word, because every sport is changing.
Yeah.
And Thomas Bach maybe has a role in that with his change or be changed sort of instruction or guidance. We really look forward now to being able to look very closely at that fan who's out there now and potentially is a new member of the community, a new supporter of what has been a sport with a very proud tradition, and a very, you know, storied tradition for over 100 years, and with a great backstory, we now need a new future for that, because it can't be modern pentathlon without being modern, and therefore the idea of tapping into a massive new trend, a new global preference, a new global community makes so much sense. So what we need to do now is get, as Johnny was saying, get the right data, so that we know exactly who we can talk to about the new opportunity provided by this sport, assuming the IOC admits modern pentathlon to future Olympics.
Right. Gigeli, we talked a little bit about sustainability earlier, and you know, obviously this is becoming a factor. Is it being driven by fans and brands? Is it being driven down from the top, from the IOC, saying you've got to be following this, or is it both? Is that one of the factors that's coming in? But are fans really driving this area? Is it important for fans?
We can feel this demand from everyone, both from the fans, but just giving a good example that we feel the same thing from our colleagues. We have quite a lot of young colleagues, and even they are asking us, what can they do? Just working on every single day on the office building, how they can do something for the environment, how they can participate in, for example, CSR activities. So, and of course, don't misunderstand me, I don't want to say it in a negative way, but we feel the push from government-related places, or I mean, like from the European Union, United Nations, from governments, IOC, that everybody should take care about sustainability. They must be active in a field of sustainability, and as we discussed previously, that the high number of followers on social media, it's not something that we want to show off. It's something to talk about, to understand the huge responsibility that we have as a federation, that how, what, and when we will communicate to our followers, because in this way we can reach millions and millions of people. So I know that we hear about sustainability, climate protection, and everything else from everywhere, but from this sustainability perspective, we try to follow the guideline of the United Nations sustainability, sustainable development goals, and we want to understand it a little bit better, how we can contribute to these goals. So, for example, for this reason, we created a sustainable development handbook, because we wanted to support our national federations everywhere to let them understand how they can contribute. Of course, we cannot compare a national federation of, I don't know, Poland or France or even Hungary to a smaller national federations with much lower number of athletes, activities, and everything else. But at least we wanted to give them some ideas that how they can contribute to the big picture. And even if they are just they just plant one single tree in Africa, but communicate about it, motivate someone. Or they can collect all the athletes and go somewhere to collect rubbish, just to highlight the importance of these kind of questions. And that's a must. And if we talk about Generation Z, they are motivated. They are naturally motivated. They're asking about it. They are looking for it. Just see how these young people actively communicate about these climate protection questions.
So, Brendan, do you see an opportunity here to really bring in a new group of fan into the sports sector through some of these areas like diversity, inclusion, climate? Are these people that we can attract into the sport, because sport's leading the way in this area?
Yes, most definitely, because as Johnny was speaking there, I basically reflected on my own country, the Commonwealth of Dominica, which has been more inclusive and representative society in the Caribbean to its mere resilience. The country has been battered by several natural disasters in the past decade, namely the Christmas Trough of December 2013, Tropical Storm Erica in 2015, and the catastrophic Hurricane Maria in 2017. These events collectively damaged over 98% of the country's infrastructure, costing approximately $1 billion. Additionally, as a small island state, the heavily dependent on tourism, we were severely impacted by COVID-19. Consequently, this led to a decline in output at 11% in 2020. But this resiliency that I speak of, it basically impacted our athletes as well, because our athletes were able to build that strong mindset, and they created a fandom who followed them because amidst the challenges and the adversities they faced through these natural disasters and through the COVID-19 pandemic, they were able to persevere and seek alternatives to succeed. And with the advent of social media, Instagram, TikTok, they basically brought you to light as to what they were doing. Additionally, with the lack of facilities, our youth within the country were still able to secure sponsorship, you know, scholarships to attend universities, represent our country at the World Championships, make it to the finals. And like I said, this resiliency, they documented every step of the way. And it drew in the fans. It drew in the fans who basically decided that they want to be advocates for social climate change. They want to be advocates for all other sustainable goals of the UN. And our athletes were able to secure medals at the Commonwealth Games, Character Games. And also, they were able to, you know, be that leader within the communities, building a fandom, their own fandom, and transforming their stories into success.
Great. I mean, I've always talked about sports very good at engaging the engaged, but not so good at engaging the unengaged. So, Johnny, are you sort of, how do we use sport to bring in people that sport doesn't reach? Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, it comes back to you know, what Brendan's talking about here is different people in different parts of the world have different challenges, different priorities in their lives. And so what we need to do is be culturally relevant to different fans in different parts of the world, which is going to mean different things to different people. But fundamentally, sport has got to connect into culture much better. And there's different areas of culture. The F1 Drive to Survive example I talked about was at that point of entry through entertainment. We're doing some work with World Athletics at the moment, which is fantastic at promoting, you know, the elite competition side of their sport, track and field. But actually, you know, the mass market, this audience scalability, a scalability option for them is actually in participation. There's many more people that just put on a pair of trainers and go out running, and that is athletics. What athletics want people to know that going running is athletics. So we launched a managing an Instagram channel called Personal Best, which is all about encouraging more people to run more often and representing what running means to people all around the world, which is very, very different things. But their motivations to participate in running has got nothing to do with elite sports or competition. It's about health, it's about well-being, it's about being social, being active. Another example of some work we did was in canoeing, which from a media interest point of view is probably one of the smaller sports. And in actual fact, to connect canoeing with culture, you've got to think about adventure travel. There's a lot of people who are interested in going paddling, not necessarily canoeing, paddling, on holiday. So we created a campaign which was all about encouraging people around the world to provide some UGC content about the best places that they go paddling. And we amplified this working with Olympians and hugely successful. But the point of entry was adventure travel. It wasn't sports. The challenge now is to continue to nurture these new fans that have a passion for the sport, but for different motivational reasons, and actually take them on a journey towards being interested in the sport that we talk about and see in stadium and competitions around the world. That's a journey that takes time. But what we've got to do is identify the different entry points and take people on a journey.
Alice, we were talking just about the social value of sport. You know, I was reflecting actually on the earlier conversations that classically sport values tourism and media coverage. But for me, social value, the importance of sport and its social benefits, is so undervalued. Do you want to chat about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's sort of my background a little bit is working with governments, local government, central government, sports organisations to help them maximise and then measure the social value that sport is delivering to a city, to a country, to a community. And I think it's just, it's something that's an expectation now of fans. You know, we talked about that actually. Fans are much more likely to connect with a sport if the values of that organisation, that sport, align with their own values, whether that's around climate action or representation, player welfare, etc. So it's really important from a fan and participation perspective. But I think in terms of if you're looking at investing public money into a major event, for example, then it's absolutely critical that you're able to demonstrate that there's an economic return on that. But as important is the social return. So what are the social benefits that we're delivering back to the communities that are in the host city of that event, for example? And there was some really interesting work done around the Commonwealth Games in Birmingham and the West Midlands in terms of building social impact and legacy into the games and the different buckets that they kind of looked at to measure. So health and well-being was a really important one. Are we able to leverage the inspirational effect of the games to get more people to be active, particularly those communities where there are high inactivity levels? What can we do to sort of shift the needle in terms of the activity levels in the population? Looking at supply chain and actually building a social value model into the procurement supply chain of the Commonwealth, supporting local SMEs. So a whole range of ways that you can build social impact into events, and critically back to the data point, what we need to be able to do is then demonstrate robustly that the social impact has been delivered through events and sports investments. Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's clear from our poll that we all think that community and social engagement is probably top priority for a lot of people. Switching hats for you, Jonathan, to your ESSA and your sort of brand sponsorship background. From a brand sponsorship perspective, what are we seeing in terms of what do they want to see in terms of fans and understanding that?
Yeah, I think wearing my other hat as my day job in the European Sponsorship Association, I'm constantly looking at sport through the eyes of a brand and trying to think, you know, how can sponsorship be more attractive, relevant and meaningful? And, you know, I've seen, you know, evidence from MKTG Frontier Study, for example, that what was rated around 22% of importance in 2016 is now 47% in 2022, and that is purpose. And purpose is obviously increasingly seen as not just something to pay lip service to, but to prove and demonstrate that your company values match those of the customers. And sport has a fascinating role in that relationship. So I'm very much looking forward to seeing how the future fan, in terms of metaverse and NFTs and anything that those people are going to be interested in, how the connections, where the traction takes place between the brand and the customer, with often the rights holder in the middle, and where the magic can actually happen.
And presumably, sport's got a great opportunity, really, in this space, because we are in the community. But I think, as Johnny was saying, we're perhaps not using it as well as we could do. And actually, these tools that are right at our fingertips. You know, I'm a park runner, for instance. You know, so for me, that's an important society piece. There's 600,000 people who run park run. But you know, are we really, as the federation, engaging into that space? And I think there's a bit of a disconnect. Matty, is that driving tech ball? Are you thinking, you know, how do I, as an international body, connect into grassroots, into that community?
The grassroots of tech ball That's a very interesting question, because we are very young sport. I mean, FITEC was established in 2017, so it's very hard to talk about grassroots when we talk about tech ball. But of course, we can see that from all over the world, we have a lot of fans who are really, really young, who, for example, cannot attend or professional tournaments because they are not 16. So under that, we can say that, yeah, they are part of our grassroots program, because we have some grassroots programs around the world, because we have 151 national federations, and we have some grassroots programs all over the different continents. So this, for us, it's a future project to deal with this question.
So, Brendan, Commonwealth Games, hugely successful for Birmingham. Was it successfully transmitted into the Caribbean? How was it received? Was it well regarded?
Yes, it was well regarded in the Caribbean, because the Commonwealth Games in the region itself is basically looked at as the platform identifying athletes who are going on to the World Championships, which we have for track and field especially, which we have next year in Hungary, and also for the Olympic Games. So a lot of the Caribbean islands, they tune in to this edition or the last edition of Commonwealth Games to look at the future stars. More so for the Commonwealth of Dominica, the people of Dominica understand the economic and political impact of inclusion in the Commonwealth greater than they do of the Games. But as Alice indicated earlier, it is basically identifying a story. And with that being said, the recent medals achieved over the past two editions of the Commonwealth Games by Dominica in athletics, and also by my appointment as chair of the Commonwealth Games Federation's Athletes Advisory Commission, has raised the profile of the Games in the country. Additionally, with now being a greater awareness that is expected for future medal performances will continue to aid the perception of the Games. And moreover, by the government of Dominica gifting our recently awarded medalists a financial gift, a lot of youth, you know, were drawn into the Games. Now they're looking forward to the youth Games, which will be held in Trinidad next year. Additionally, the Queen's Baton Relay, which is affiliated with the Games, is well known among Dominican society, especially amongst athletes, schools, and indigenous people, as additional effort is placed to incorporate them in activities and media highlights. So we are within the region. We not only focus on the sport, but also the social impact that the Commonwealth Games is trying to achieve. We have, this year we had, where we had the Athlete Advocacy Guiding Principles, where athletes were able to speak about social issues. So it's bridging the gap and understanding that the Commonwealth Games is now raising the platform for athletes to be more than athletes, but be advocates for change.
It's very interesting. I mean, so the project I'm running, Global Sustainable Sport, is really looking at the fact that we've got 4 billion sports fans, maybe even 5 billion sports fans around the world. I think we're running out of time. I'm looking at Ben to sort of go, should we be wrapping up 5 minutes? So I think we've probably just got a time for a view from each person. Are we as an industry using our platform, the sports platform, well enough to kind of communicate the sort of the changing world that we're living in? I mean, change or be changed, I think that's kind of the theme of the day, isn't it? We've got this amazing platform. How does sport, Johnny, couple of words from each of you, how does sport use its platform well to really affect this change?
Sport traditionally is not been great at marketing because it's such a great product. It doesn't have to work hard. If you look at other industry sectors, there's a much greater focus on brand and building the brand. Marketing effectiveness comes, you know, the biggest indicator of marketing effectiveness is actually brand strength. Sport needs to grow and build its brand beyond the elite competition. It needs to connect with people in a relevant way, depending on what that means, where you are around the world. And as Brendan's talking about a lot, it's actually using methods of communicating with people that can influence more people. And the use of athletes is a fantastic way to do that. A lot of our work working with international rights holders is actually helping to put together education programs for national federations and athletes to be able to increase the influence of communications in nations around the world. But fundamentally, it's thinking about sport's got to think bigger than just the elite competition, the performance on the field of play. It's got to connect into culture across many different areas in order to be more relevant today.
Alice.
Yeah, and I think just in terms of the relevancy point, we've seen some interesting developments with the Commonwealth Games format, actually, in terms of now I think there are just two sports that have to be delivered as part of future games, athletics and swimming. And so actually, I think it's really interesting to look at those models that are trying to connect with those younger fans in a way that are adjusting formats of the sport to sort of cater for their demands, for their needs, linking in with the local community. So actually, are there sports that are better sort of served within those local communities and better fitted into the programme? So I think that's a really interesting thing in terms of format and the way you both format a sport but also deliver content. And the other key one for me would be around values and purpose and actually not just sort of talking about it but delivering on it as well.
Jonathan.
I think it can be quite difficult for rights holders sometimes to take responsibility for communicating the benefits of sport because there is so much pressure, so much competition. But I do think that responsibility lies with government and lies with umbrella bodies and funding organisations. I did work for Sport Scotland for many years right here in Glasgow, and to be able to look very closely at the pure benefits of sport was really nice because sport changes lives, it improves lives, it saves lives, and there's a massive, huge panorama of benefits which we often forget about when we're, you know, very much caught up in the day-to-day. But I do think any opportunity to amplify that and communicate the benefits of sport should be taken by every organisation involved.
Matty.
We always say that we are proud, and I can say that Greg agrees with that. We love working for Tagball because we started this whole project, and we always say that we give health and we give a new sport for the world, those of course who uses or tables. And this is something important from emotional point of view, that we didn't give a new type of gun to the world, but a new sport and a new table, which is a multifunctional table. You can play more sports on it. And this is, I think, important. This is what we communicate all the time, that, yeah, we use our tables, sometimes we donate tables to cities, and we say, put it in the park and ask everybody to use it, because then they will be healthier. And I think this is important.
Brendan?
Yes, well, if I may use the slogan from the Birmingham 2022 Commonwealth Games, sport is only just the beginning. That means, though we have our athletes coming in to showcase their talents, we have the opportunity to allow the athletes to bring in other fans or bring the future fan into the sport by engaging on their social platforms. You know, we have athletes who advocate for just causes, and they bring in their fandom who support their entire journey. And that just means bridging the gap between their social causes and sports. So you have that following who not only comes to engage in sport, but are engaging what everything that they are doing. And then they will bring in other persons as well. So like I said, sports is just beginning to grow a community and bring in new fans.
Great. That's a nice lead into the Birmingham Commonwealth Games area. I don't know if we've got any questions. We probably out of time for questions, are we, I guess? So. Do you want to just, anyone got a question? We got a question here. Two inside the games questions. Are we allowed two inside the games questions? So who's going to go, Duncan?
Jonathan, Duncan Carr from Inside the Games. By your own admission, modern pentathlon's been in the Olympics 110 years, yet has failed to really make much impression outside Olympic years. And you've it's so far from the original concept of Brown de Kubikan. Does it still deserve a place in the Olympics when there's so many more sports, have bigger fan bases, more participations, and are more engaging?
Uh, I think the proof will be in the pudding. The proposal that's being made now to the IOC for a brand new version of modern pentathlon, which is designed to future-proof the sport, but also for the sport to appeal to a massive new demographic around the world, and not only that, but bring that demographic to the Olympic Games, because nobody thinks that any sport should have a divine right to be in the Olympic Games. It has to add value to the Games itself and to grow the audience. So for that reason, I do think that the proposal currently being worked on is really essential to answer that question.
Anyone else? Yeah, up here.
No, yeah. Chris Jordan from Birmingham City Council. So, Alice, I was interested in your point around trying to make sport as easy to take part in through the LTA as ordering your takeaway or your curry or whatever. But perhaps the point is that actually you need to be able to do that in a way whereby you can order not just the curry, but Chinese or fish and chips. So my question is, how are the federation, sport, and event organisers trying to come together to tackle a common purpose? Because it seems quite individual when you're talking about the LTA in that sense.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I was sort of reflecting on the partnership that we have with the LTA across sport in general, and driven by Sport England. There is a big push around open data through the Open Active program, and that's really, you know, sport agnostic. So the whole driver of that is that we know we have communities that are finding it hard to get active and stay active. And I think that the research was saying that one of the key barriers around that was people just don't know where and how. So the whole driver around that program is to open up data. So in other words, that could be, you know, a boot camp in your local park, it could be a tennis court in your local park, it could be however you want to get active. It could be a walking group. It's not really about which sport, it's about which sport or physical activity is going to best connect with those communities. And so I agree with you. I think it's not just about a single sport. It's about sports coming together to open up the offer.
Great. I think we'll wrap it up there. But I think, you know, one more here. Sorry.
Yeah, just a small one. I'm Maxwell De Silva from Sri Lanka. This is to my friend Matt from TechBall. I have seen the tremendous growth in TechBall during the last few years. Congratulations. And my question is, based on whatever we heard today, sustainability and gender equity, I am yet to see how do you intend getting it done, particularly in Asia, because I felt that your sport event is mostly European centered. I'm sorry if I am wrong. Thank you.
From next year, actually, we have a event calendar, and we will organize many events in Asia. So there will be at least 6 events. So we focus on the USA with 12 events, and there will be some in Europe, but we will organize in Asia and in Australia as well. Sorry, I didn't understand the first part of the question about the gender equality. Gender equality is absolutely important. That's why we always organize men and women singles and doubles as well, and mixed doubles. Our aim is, and we actually follow IOC, the 50% of, we would like to reach the real gender equality. And we have programs for that, because of course, table is a football-based sport, and more men play football than women. So it's not an easy question, but we have programs for that. So we are really focusing on that.
Great, thank you very much. A big thank you to all our panelists. Great conversation. Thank you very much indeed.